Welcome to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, airing live on unceded Coast Salish territories in British Columbia. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only animal advocacy radio program, bringing you all you need to keep you up to date with what's happening locally and abroad, from interviews with amazing change makers around the world to news, events, and lifestyle. Animal Voices can be heard live every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and can also be streamed at cooperadio.org. Or if you check out animalvoices.org for podcasts soon after airing or other news events and stuff on that website. Joining me in studio today, we have Cynthia.
Hello.
Darren.
Hi.
Our guest, Wayne.
Hey.
And we have Amir.
Hey.
So, well, thank you for joining me, everyone. Today is March 6th, and like I mentioned, today we have Wayne Chung from International Animal Liberation Network, Direct Action Everywhere, or DXE, in studio with us today. We will speak with him about the open rescue and investigation that was recently released out of a farm that supplies eggs to Whole Foods. And as tomorrow is International Women's Day, we will lead into a discussion about the exploitation of female bodies that takes place against animals by industry and the connections between feminism and animal rights. We'll also share parts of an interview that previous Animal Voices host Jenny Rempel did with Ashley Meyer in 2014 on the topic of sexual violence within activist circles and the connections between feminism and animal rights. All right, so Wayne, thanks for joining us today. You took part in an open rescue that was released just a few months ago. Can you start by explaining what the term open rescue means and how that differs from other liberations or investigations?
Sure. So I'm sure many of your viewers and listeners, I should say, have heard about undercover investigations, which have been done for most of the past decade by large nonprofit organizations. These are investigations where people try to get employment at these facilities and legally use concealed cameras to document the conditions inside these farms. Open rescue is very different. Open rescue involves directly going into farms without the consent of the owners, under cover of night usually, but sometimes in broad daylight, and documenting conditions and more importantly, rescuing some of the animals. We take out distressed animals, we give them veterinary care, we give them the lives that they deserved. It's different from ALF raids in the sense that we do this openly. We do this with no masks on, and we do this to create public dialogue and show that ordinary people, people like your brothers, your sisters, your cousins, your coworkers, are doing these things and believe that animals deserve to be freed from these places of violence and pain. So we rescued a number of hens from a facility in Northern California and got public press coverage and I think 50 different press articles and journals across the country and immobilized a campaign that has now had, I think, around 100 cities participate just in the past 2.5 months. So we're really excited about it and hope the attention continues over the next few months.
And what kind of planning went into this rescue?
I've been doing this sort of work for about 10 years of some investigatory work of some variety, and what you learn is the more you plan, the better the results are at the end of the day. And so, you know, the investigation itself spanned about a year and a half. There was probably a six-month process of putting a team together, researching potential targets, thinking about campaigning afterwards. Because one of the things I've learned is that if you do an investigation and even a rescue and you don't have a campaign and a community around it, its effect is not going to be very good. And sometimes people end up getting in quite a bit of trouble. And I've had a number of friends get in quite a bit of trouble for this sort of work, and something I've learned over 10 years of experience. So I think the most important things are one, consult with lawyers before you do this. Two, find a team of people you really trust, you believe in. And three, think very carefully about your target, both the corporation you'd like to campaign against once you do the investigation, but also think about the jurisdiction it's in, the lawyers and the district attorneys who could potentially be bringing charges against you. And one of the reasons we focused in Northern California was because we felt like it was an area of the country where the public would be fairly receptive, and that's proven to be true.
Great. And what situation were the animals in this farm in when you found them?
Sure. So this is a farm that was described as certified humane and cage-free by Whole Foods. They had a picture on the egg cartons of two little girls and a hen in a big grassy field. The conditions we found in this farm were very, very different, and they were nightmarishly violent. So there were tens of thousands of hens in this facility covered in feces, mutilated. In one case, we found a hen with a dismembered wing. Every single one of these hens was distressed. Every single one of these hens was confined in farms that were completely indoors, where they received an average of 1.5 square feet of space. And we saw hundreds of hens with our own eyes who were dead or dying, and we rescued a number of them and took them to the vet because we felt like we had a moral obligation. When we went into this facility, we didn't necessarily intend on taking any animals out. We felt like we had a moral and, in fact, legal obligation to give these animals the attention, the care, the compassion, respect that they had been denied by Whole Foods and the farmer.
And what was your emotional experience or your emotional response upon entering and being in the barns surrounded by so much death and despair?
The only way I can describe it is it's kind of like going through some sort of dimensional portal where something you just can't imagine does exist, and it's worse than you possibly could have ever imagined, even in your worst nightmares. And I think the first thing you notice, even as you're approaching a facility like this, is the smell, where the ammonia and feces, this particular facility had a latrine that was probably the size of 4 football fields. And as you're getting close, you just start smelling and even feeling, like in the air, that there's something not quite right about the land that you're walking on, the air that you're breathing. And then once you walk into a facility, the first thing that strikes you is just the confinement and how outrageous it is that farms can describe these conditions as free range, cage free, and exploit the sympathy that human beings have towards animals, that the public cares about animals and doesn't want to see animals confined. And they're marketing these products as certified humane, free range, and cage free, and the animals are packed so tightly they're often standing on top of each other and so congested they can't spread their wings or turn around properly. And so you start seeing these huge masses, and it's a little bit of a head trip because I'm someone who has had a lot of really amazing experiences with chickens and hens, and I feel like I have a lot of compassion, and I feel like a lot of chickens are my friends. I mean, they're companions to me just as dogs and cats are. And it's impossible to see the individuality of any of the hens inside these facilities because it's a huge mass. Every single one of these barns had anywhere from 5,000 to 25,000 hens, and that's just one barn out of 24. Right, and you see these huge masses, and you just lose sight of everything. And the only thing it can remind me of is descriptions of people who have witnessed concentration camps for people, where you see these huddled masses, and it's horrifying, and also it makes you realize that in these places of violence, all personhood, all dignity, all emotional sophistication and complexity has been lost in the pursuit of profit and greed. And it's why I think these rescues and investigations are so important, because we have to breach the cognitive gap that people have between what their food looks like and what corporations are telling them is happening to these animals and what is actually happening.
Yeah, and I think that the kind of what you just described, how they're losing their individuality, probably makes it easier for workers to deal with them in the way that they do, because they don't see them as individuals.
Yeah.
So since you were able to rescue some hens, how did you come to the difficult decision of which ones to rescue?
Open rescue historically has strategically focused on distressed hens for two reasons. One is in terms of storytelling, and in terms of kind of immediate need, emergency need, they're the ones who are most in need, and that tells the most compelling story to the public that you know, this is a hen who obviously has no more economic value. She's been abused her entire life. She's at the precipice of death. We're taking her out only to give her veterinary care. And then also has the ancillary benefit of somewhat insulating you from legal scrutiny and prosecution, because the hens that we take out of this facility have no value. In many ways, economically, we're doing the farm a favor, because at this point, the animals are a disposal problem. They would need to be culled. They would need to be removed from the facility. We're doing something different. We're taking them out. We're giving them care. We're rescuing them and trying to bring them back to life. And in most cases, chickens are the most amazing animals. They can bounce back from the most horrific torment and trauma and be flourishing, beautiful creatures, the flourishing, beautiful creatures they deserve to be. And that's what's happened with every single one of the hens we took out of this facility. And but the selection process is, you know, we look at hens who are in most dire, immediate need, and we take them out, and we secure kind of the resources, the facilities, and the veterinary care we know we might need before we even go in, and take them directly to an emergency vet where they can be cared for.
Great. And I know in the video you told the story of May, yeah, and her, you know, remarkable recovery. Can you just tell our listeners how long it took for May to adjust outside of life, outside of the farm, and what her recovery process was like?
So Meihua still really hasn't completely adjusted. She's recovered immensely, but as with many victims of traumatic violence, animals who are rescued from farms are never the way they would be if they had been given good lives. And so, you know, May, when we found her, she was at approximately one-third of her normal body weight. She was dehydrated and starved. She was stuck in a pile of filth where she had been abandoned. And the vet thinks she had probably been there for maybe up to 2 weeks, completely ignored. But, within a span of about a week, she was standing again, which is amazing given the first vet we took her to was sure that she would be dead within hours. And it only took her a week of, I mean, it did take a lot of care, and she had constant pretty much 24 hours of supervision. It took a lot of IVs, feeding, and fluids to make sure she got the fluids and food that she needed. But with that sort of emergency care, you know, within a week she was standing. Within 2 weeks she was walking around. Within 3 weeks she was able to go outside and hang out with other hens. But even to this day, you know, she isn't able to run. She walks. She's not quite as alert and sophisticated as the other hens, so she has to be separated from other hens because hens, like a lot of social animals, often aren't so nice to those who are weaker than them. So she needs a little bit of protection from the flock because they see her as very slow and weak. It's hard for her to like barge in and fight for food, that sort of thing, because she is just a little different than the other hens. So, but she's also just incredibly sweet and gentle and has the same emotional sophistication as the other chickens. And you can see this because when you walk in, depending on what you're bringing here, for example, if she knows you're coming and you're planning to take her somewhere, you have like a little crate, she's like, oh, I don't know if I want to be with you. And so she'll walk to the other side of the room very slowly the way she walks. But if you walk in and you have food or something, she'll be very energetic and alert and follow you around and cluck and make all the noises.
Very much like a dog or cat.
Exactly like,
yeah,
a dog or cat. And it's, you know, one of the things you realize when you spend a lot of times with hens or really any species of animal is their way of communicating is so elegant and beautiful, but it's just so different. It's so, so different. And so a big part of what we're trying to accomplish with Open Rescues is translate these animal stories and show people that the dog or cat you love at home and who you know can communicate with you is really no different than this chicken. They just talk a different language.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Wayne, just had a quick question for you. I think since this investigation, DXE has kind of received quite a bit of criticism, surprisingly, from other animal advocates, particularly because so much of the investigation focuses on talking about and describing the horrific conditions inside these farms. So you end up being forced to talk a lot about, you know, the small, tiny spaces of confinement. And I think from what I've seen, some of the stuff online, DXE has been sort of criticized as becoming more welfareist. So sure. I was wondering if you had, you know, some thoughts and statements or responses to those criticisms.
Sure. Many of the critics are people I admire immensely. So Gary Francione is someone I've read for, you know, almost 2 decades, and I respect his work incredibly. He's offered a lot of insightful critiques of the animal rights movement. I think it serves all of us well to listen to folks like him and any critics, you know, who have thoughts on the work that we can do that's better. But 100% absolutely unequivocal, DXE is a group that endorses total animal liberation. And I think the reason we focus on some of the horrific conditions, the nightmarish abuse the animals face at this particular farm, are twofold. One is that our position is that animal slavery and animal confinement and animal agriculture are inherently violent. And what we did was we found the best of the best facility. This is a farm that was celebrated by Whole Foods, that was certified humane under the most aggressive standards that exist, and we found the same abusive, nightmarish conditions that you see in animal farms. But the second thing is, you know, one of the things you realize when you interact with these animals is it doesn't matter how you're abusing and using them. If they're not given an opportunity to flourish, if they're not given freedom, if they're not given social companionship the way they would if they were at a sanctuary or in someone's home, they're inevitably going to be harmed in significant fundamental ways. So May will never be able to interact with other hens the way a normal hen would be, and that's partly because of the trauma and confinement and concentration, that the concentration camp-like conditions she lived in for the first 2 years of her life. And so it doesn't really matter exactly how good the conditions are, even if they had cleaned the barn every day, even if they had been giving the hens veterinary care. Just the fact of confinement, the denial of all the natural behaviors these hens normally would engage in, is itself inherently abusive. So I'm not a big fan of the welfarist versus the abolitionist dichotomy, but to the extent you're going to place us somewhere, absolutely, we're in the abolitionist camp. And I hope people understand that when they look at our work, that our message is not that we have to do animal agriculture better, but that the entire system is abusive and violent and simply has to go.
Great. And you're also doing a tour talking about Open Rescue. What cities are you going to be going to? Here, obviously, but...
Sure. So the only one I can remember off the top of my head, or the only ones I can remember, are the ones that are in the immediate future. And we'll be in Vancouver, obviously, tomorrow at UBC. I'll be at Portland Lewis and Clark Law School on next Monday. And then I'll be at the University of Oregon Law School on, I think it's next Wednesday. We'll be in a number of cities in the East Coast. The ones off the top of my head that I know we're going to are New Haven, New York City, Providence, and Hanover, New Hampshire, where Dartmouth is located. So I highly encourage folks to come out, and if you have any feedback or questions about this program, what we're trying to do with it, please come out to one of these events and ask us questions. I think face-to-face communication is always the best. But even beyond kind of being a part of the Open Rescue Network as a participant and an audience member, I highly encourage people to look into this work yourselves, because one of the beauties of Open Rescue work as opposed to undercover investigations is that all of us can do this.
Yeah.
If you have a smartphone and big heart, you can go into one of these facilities. They're not very far from where you live. Animal agriculture is everywhere, but it's hidden behind closed doors, and we need to go into these places of violence and expose what's happening and rescue the victims.
Absolutely. Thanks, Wayne, for sharing that. And yeah, I think it's really important what you said. Everyone can do this. Anyone can do this. So that was Wayne of Direct Action Everywhere. To find out more or get involved in your area, check out Direct Action Everywhere on Facebook. And I hope to see a lot of our listeners at the talk, which will be tomorrow at 3:30 at UBC. And you can find out more about that on Facebook.
So March 8th is International Women's Day. It's a global day celebrating the social and political achievements of women past, present, and future, while also reflecting on where inequality still exists. Women's Day is mostly focused on human women, and our sisters from other species are often not mentioned. Every day, billions of non-human females are treated as commodities and exploited for food, clothing, and entertainment. These women are enslaved, repeatedly impregnated, and their children are stolen. When they are no longer of use to the meat industry, they are brutally slaughtered for their skin and flesh. It is the female reproductive systems that fill the dairy, cheese, and egg aisles in our supermarkets. All women, both human and non-human, deserve the right to have autonomy over their own bodies. And so as Wayne was talking about these hens, these women that are in these facilities, it's often that they're not spoken about. And it's quite sad that for Women's Day that we don't talk about our non-human animal species, sister species. So today we're talking about them and how they also deserve the right to be free from suffering, to have autonomy over their own bodies. Often these women are enslaved and repeatedly impregnated on apparatuses that farmers call rape racks, which, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. also,
it's,
yeah.
It's an industry term, actually, which is interesting that they, yeah, they make that connection themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, they call it rape racks. And so feminism is connected to animal rights. And there's been many books about the sexual politics of meat, a book called The Sexual Politics of Meat by Carol J. Adams. And one of the quotes from her book is, eating animals acts as a mirror and a representation of patriarchal values. Meat eating is the reinscription of male power at every meal. If eating meat is a symbol of male dominance, then the presence of meat proclaims the disempowering of women. And oftentimes you'll see this in advertising and marketing. You'll see burgers sold with, air quotes, sexy women. Or, for example, recently I just saw this new event that is taking place.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier.
We're talking about this earlier, called Steak and Blowjob Day, which happens on March 14th. And on their website, it says... March 14th should be Men's Valentine's Day, and the male equivalent of flowers and chocolate is steak and blowjobs, of course.
Yeah, because, well, first of all, like, what does that even mean, male equivalent of Valentine's Day? Like, it's only, because it's only a woman's holiday because women are love chocolate and flowers, and that's all that Valentine's Day is, essentially. I don't know, it's weird.
Yeah, and earlier you said, with flowers and chocolates are things that you can buy or commodities,
yeah,
and so
yeah.
Steak and blowjobs are also...
They're commodities.
Commodities.
Completely, obviously.
Yeah. And, you know, you can see this directly on the website. So I went to the website, unfortunately, to do research for this segment, and on the website, there are photos of women mixed with pictures of steak, and there's even a photo of a woman from, I think, like the 60s, and she's grilling, like, this... big steak, and there's women in bikinis, and it's just really like everything that the sexual politics of meat, you know, is about the fact that women are commodified and their bodies are seen as meat, and these female Absolutely. Bodies are used in the meat industry. So for this female, for this Women's Day, we also salute our, you know, females out there. And, you know, they're also fighting back. There's women, there's stories of mothers, dairy mothers who hide their children. There was recently a story, yeah. she was on a sanctuary, but a pregnant dairy cow was rescued, and she gave birth to her calf, and she hid her calf in the grass because she knew that humans steal baby calves. And so she keeps hiding her calf, and even though she's at a sanctuary and they're trying to make her comfortable, and like you're mentioning with me, that these animals are so scarred from these industries that, you know, they can never really have their normal behaviors. So she's taking care of her baby, but she's protecting her baby from the humans.
And I think that like humans have trauma too, like from past experiences. And it just goes to show like animals are not so dense, as, air quotes again, as people think they are, that they do remember these things. They do have triggers. They do, you know, have complex emotional memories. And yeah, just the fact that story, I read that story too, that was really powerful to see. Not surprising though, but really powerful still.
Yeah, and it's not the first case. I've heard of another story as well mm-hmm. of a dairy cow hiding. She had twins and she hid one twin and she gave one of the twin calves to the farmer. And so we also did a show a couple years back with on Animal Voices, and we interviewed Lisa Kemmerer, who wrote Sister Species. So check out our website, animalvoices.org, and look up that interview, because that's a great interview that talks about these connections as well. And I'm just going to end with a poem that was actually written by Jackie, but I'm going to read it, which I think really connects what we're talking about here. So, liberate ourselves from these cages, constructed by society to restrict us, bind us, and keep us unseen. Our pain is invisible as money rolls in. We are not seen as individuals, but as objects to get their fill. To follow what we are told, either willingly or with force. Images pollute our minds. They control and manipulate. We are shackled in their restraints, held back as others are hurled forth. Knocked down, beaten, and abused. Our struggles so invisible, yet our suffering so real. How much more will we take? We must break free from these locks and step out of our cages.
All right, thanks.
That was beautiful. Some events coming up, actually. If you want to get involved in the movement to do some peaceful activism, Liberation BC will be doing leafletting regarding the humane myth, which we are sold so often. This is in a couple weeks on March the 25th at 5:30. They will meet at Grandview Park. The humane myth, as we know, is the idea that we can kill and exploit animals, or really any beings, humanely, which obviously we all agree is completely and inherently wrong and sort of an outright lie, in my opinion. The Vancouver Institute will also present a public lecture by Stefan Ostermuhl, who is the executive director of the Peruvian dolphin defender group, Mundo Azul, who worked to expose the captivity and illegal dolphin hunt in Peru, where thousands are killed each year, sold illegally, or used as shark bait. It's on March the 28th at UBC and starts at 8:15 in the Woodward Instructional Resources Center. Coming up soon also, something that Darren, Jackie, you guys will be leading is a protest at the Greater Vancouver Zoo. I think this is a fantastic idea because, I mean, I don't think people often realize what an animal being held captive at a zoo symbolizes, and especially for children who don't really understand what's going on when they go to a zoo. Maybe, Darren, you can share what inspired this protest.
So I think one of the reasons why we wanted to target the Greater Vancouver Zoo was because this place has been sort of on the activist radar for a really long time, but due to its location, it hasn't been really practical for people to actually go out there and put pressure on them. And secondly, it has a just a really brutal, tragic history of just violent animal abuse and neglect. Even welfare organizations like the BCSPCA has at numerous times basically charged them with animal cruelty. So this is a place where, in our opinion, should have been like gone, you know, decades ago, but it's still around. So I think this year we feel like there are a lot of activists in the area who are really interested, and we have the momentum and we have the energy, and we're just gonna throw some pressure on them and see where that goes.
Yeah, what really bothers me about zoos is that people sort of look at them as sort of educational, but when you're putting animals in a place that's outside of their natural habitat, I mean, how can we really say that's educational, because we're not seeing how they, you know, would be in their natural environment. So, you know, I think it's a great idea. And Jackie, I think you were going to mention the Open Rescue event again, right?
No, I mentioned it earlier. Oh, okay. Don't worry about it.
Okay, yeah, that was it for the events. But if you have any upcoming animal-friendly events that you guys would like to share with us, feel free to connect with us on the web via Facebook Animal Voices Vancouver or Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. We'd love to hear some of your ideas.
Thanks so much, Amir. So Ashley Meyer, for those of you that don't know, is a contributing author to Lantern's books, 2013 Defiant Daughters, 21 Women on Art, Activism, Animals, and the Sexual Politics of Meat. She currently collaborates on Project Intersect, a publication focused on radical earth, animal, and feminist liberation. Ashley has also worked for many years in sexual assault prevention, protection, and advocacy. So we will share an interview that, like I mentioned earlier, Jenny Rempel, our previous host, had done in 2014.
So what have been the biggest lessons that you've learned from doing that sort of outreach and work?
Well, the biggest lessons that I've learned when it comes to animal liberation and animal rights is that, you know, we still have a long way to go. Doing this work has really, really made me connect the dots. So, you know, really early on, I was thinking, wow, we always talk about norms, these unspoken standards for behavior. And we're always saying we need to change these. We need to, you know, really look at hypermasculinity and limited roles for women. And I'm absolutely on board with all of that. And I've looked at expanding. The biggest lesson for me is we really need to start, like I said before, connecting those dots. If we're going to prevent something like sexual and domestic violence, we need to look at how all of our behaviors, all of the norms around those behaviors really support such violence. And for me, that is, you know, what are we doing at, you know, three or, you know, plus or minus times a day? We're eating a lot of times, it's, you know, the bodies of animals, the products of animals, things that exploit the female reproductive system. How can we allow that to occur and think that we're going to be able to prevent these manifestations like sexual and domestic violence, manifestations of oppression?
And what is the connection for you between feminism and animal rights or other social justice causes?
Well, for me, I say, you know, my feminism and my veganism just cannot be separated. They go hand in hand. And so there are a lot of connections. I'm very much informed by and inspired by the work of Carol J. Adams. And so I think a lot of what is core to feminism really is also core to animal liberation. And that's things like bodily autonomy. I think that's things like, you know, reproductive justice and freedom. And it's things like consent, these norms that I really work on promoting every day in my work life absolutely then cross over when you expand your view. You know, some say expand your circle of compassion. So there is a connection there. What we're doing when we are, you know, farming animals, when we're utilizing their products for our own, is we're really having a power over approach. And in feminism, we talk about the use of power. We talk about who is it who we allow to have power, who we give power to, who we seem as deserving of power, and how do we use that? We say, you know, there's no hierarchies. We really need to eliminate false dichotomies, either or. And when I look at our treatment of animals, it's humans or animals. And then humans are absolutely above animals and, you know, more deserving, to the point of we can kill animals, we can exploit their reproductive systems, so we can get what we want. So it's all about challenging this kind of might makes right mentality. Just because I can have power over you, just because I have social power over you, just because I perhaps have physical power over you, doesn't mean that I can and should be exploiting you. And, you know, it's a kind of a really simple way of showing there's just these really entwined connections between both movements and our core fundamental beliefs.
And how do you see the environment relate to that?
Well, you know, I think what I've found in doing this work is it's hardest for folks who aren't on board necessarily with this connectionist perspective to really understand that. And so that's a really good question. But again, I think if we look at it in terms of power, if we look at it in terms of our use of power and its impacts and how that sends messages throughout society, throughout our communities, then I think that helps people make the connection. We exploit land because we can. We take land from people because we can. We, you know, I sometimes like to think about it as if I'm looking at what we're doing and I'm a child, what message am I getting? Because maybe I haven't, you know, this hasn't been normalized for me yet. And what I'm seeing is, oh, if I want it and I can get the power, if I have the power, I can take it. We do the same thing with our environment. We do the same thing with, you know, the destruction of the environment. And there's such a connection there to then human rights as well that I think that that's the piece where you can start to see how that absolutely, there's a thread there, makes that connection.
I'm wondering what you think of the use of certain language that might be offensive to people in feminist communities or people that have been affected by domestic violence, using words like rape or sexual assault in terms of animals. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever a good idea to co-opt language of another movement, to co-opt language of survivor experiences. I think that, unfortunately, a lot of animal rights campaigns have done that. And to me, that's one of the saddest things to see because, you know, feminism, you know, violence against women movement, there I see some of our most potential and likely allies. And when we have campaigns that are coming out, one campaign that came out fairly recently was basically a copy of a campaign that had been done with survivors of rape and other forms of sexual violence. And, you know, right away, that just turned people to say, well, you know, I don't even care. Maybe I knew what was happening and I was feeling bad about, you know, the chicken that I was eating or the eggs or whatever that I was eating, but I'm going to actively, I have seen people do this. They say, I will actively eat meat because of what is happening, because of this co-opting of our movement and our language. So when folks are saying, you know, things are being raped and really kind of more kind of nonchalantly or even just without a lot of thought behind it, taking those words, it's just so, it can be triggering, it can be damaging, and really it just turns people off from the movement as a whole, which is what we don't want to do.
And before I'd asked you how you might promote animal rights in feminist communities, but I'm curious about the opposite. Do you have any tips for promoting feminism or reducing domestic violence in animal rights communities?
Yes, I do. One of the things that I think is key still, and it's sad for me to say this because I can tell you I was saying this in 2007 when I was talking to some folks like Marty Heal, and you know, we were talking about the just the absolute prevalence of domestic and sexual violence in animal rights, and I think it's in a lot of movements. I'm hearing a lot about it in the environmental justice movement as well. I think that one of the main things is we have to just start addressing it. We have to name it. We have to... Those of us who can, I think, have to be really honest and open about the fact that it's there and just, you know, get in there and be at the tables. I think in both sides, you know, in all movements, one of the best things we can do is be at the table. And I can tell you it's not easy. It's not at all. I know a lot of folks, myself included, who have not had a very easy time. I could easily say, well, I'm just not going to engage then in animal liberation or animal rights, but I will. You know, that's something I'm able to do, so I will. I was a couple years ago, I was at an animal rights conference, and when people found out what I did, I immediately became the advocate for folks who would point to, you know, see that guy over there? He's been stalking me. See that guy over there? He raped me. I mean, I had so many disclosures. You know, for a while, I was thinking to myself, this wasn't the only conference this has happened to. Every time people find out what my expertise is around, this happens to me. And at that time, I said, okay, I'm not going to any more of these. I said, I'm done. I'm done with, you know, being here in this kind of environment because it's just so hard. But I don't think that's fair. I think that as someone who does have that expertise, I need to be at the table. And I know many, many other people who have joined me and who I hope will join me.
So in the animal rights community, what can we do to prevent gendered violence?
In the animal rights community, to prevent gendered violence, I think that we can start pointing out some of the norms that we're perpetuating, especially through our campaigns. I think we have to start with what is the work we're doing and how are we doing it? So in terms of what is the work that we're doing, you know, are our campaigns sexist? We do not live in a post, you know, a post-sexism or a post-racism or a post-any-ism world right now. And I've heard that from so many folks within animal rights that, oh, we've dealt with that. That's okay. Let's sell the sexy, right? Well, I mean, you know, if we know our audience, one, it's just realistically, it's not going to work. I mean, let's just be realistic about it. That's not going to work. And two, it's harmful. You know, you can't end one form or manifestation of oppression by using another. And so we really have to start critically analyzing our campaigns and honestly just being less willing to use another ism to try to promote the well-being of animals. I think that we look at how we do our work as well. We need to look at who is it who's behind the work. Who is it who we're promoting? Believe me, sexual and domestic violence have the same thing happening, but you know, there's a lot for us around engaging men. And I recently wrote something about the glass escalator effect in sexual and domestic violence. And you know, it was really, really kind of concerning for folks. I got a lot of response to it, but I've definitely seen this in animal rights as well, where, you know, basically men get promoted to head positions. Maybe they haven't been in the movement as long or they haven't maybe done as much work, but we kind of have this escalator leading men to the top. It's all about looking at how are we using and promoting power as well. And that's not to say men shouldn't be in positions of power, but we really need to see, is our movement equitable? And I would say that it's not just animal rights. I can say it about domestic and sexual violence movements as well, that, you know, I do think we have a problem with that. And if we're trying to kind of challenge norms around power and these kind of power over approaches, we have to look within.
So what are some things activists can do to create safer spaces?
So for safer spaces, I think that it's really important to look at the language we're using. You had mentioned that before. What is the language we're using? Also, what are the assumptions we're making? Because sexual and domestic violence is so incredibly prevalent that we know in any group that we're in doing animal rights work, there is most likely going to be a survivor of sexual violence, sexual abuse, domestic violence, some sort of violence against women, or gendered violence. And we have got to stop making assumptions. And what is often most, I guess, problematic for folks is this feeling of, you're making an assumption about my identity and my experience. And so if we not only don't make assumptions, but if we pay attention to the fact that there are likely survivors surrounding us, I think that's going to help us kind of, you know, mitigate some of what I was just talking about and kind of have a filter, a good filter, you know, not a bad one like, you know, oh, censorship and everything that people don't like to talk about. But really filter and really think intentionally about, wow, what might be the experiences of people who I'm working with and what might be triggering or harmful? You know, not everybody is me. I mean, if we could just start there, not everybody is me or has had my experience, it's going to be really great. But really think about your language. Always, always, we need to have resources, know about resources, have a person like me who knows about resources. And also, I would say, if we're not experts on something like sexual and domestic violence, and let's not pretend like we are, the more honest we can be about that, you know, wow, I really care about this. I really care about this issue. And, you know, I'm not an advocate. Let's get you connected to an advocate. Or I'm not someone who really knows a lot about what works in sexual violence prevention, but let's bring in someone who does. Just really honest and open. So you don't have to know everything. You just have to be willing to address it and to find folks you can work with to address that issue effectively.
So I'm wondering, for women that might be in an unsafe space or at risk of experiencing sexual or domestic violence related to the AR community or elsewhere, what are some red flags people should look for?
Well, in terms of red flags, you know, it's a difficult thing to talk about because one of the things is, very commonly, if you talk about something like domestic violence, you know, that doesn't happen. You don't start seeing kind of those markers that this person is, you know, violent, not safe, controlling. You don't usually see those things until women used to say to me, like, he got me. He got me. I got pregnant. We moved in together, you know, far away from my family. Things that, you know, he was great up until the moment we were alone. So it's kind of hard to talk about red flags in that context, because we know that in that case, you know, folks who perpetuate the abuse, abusers, or sometimes they're called perpetrators, aren't really going to show red flags. And, you know, the same with sexual violence. Most often it's someone you know. And so a lot of times it's a friend. You never would have thought that they would have done that to you. So I think the biggest thing is for folks to really be supportive. If you find out that someone has experienced sexual or domestic violence, the more support you can find, the better. Folks have a tendency to say, well, you should do this or you should do that. But it's like I said before, everyone's an individual. They all have, you know, different options and different reasons for or for not using those options. So there's a great book called To Be an Anchor in the Storm. It's specific to domestic violence. But it's a really great book that's about how to be that friend or family member. And, you know, I would say I've been in a lot of animal rights spaces, or they've been great supportive community spaces. But I don't know that I would have thought if something, you know, happened to me, maybe if someone in the group had, you know, assaulted me or done, you know, harassed me, something like that, I don't know that I would have felt like I could talk to anyone else in the group. So I think it's all about staying open and staying helpful and really, really kind of projecting the idea, really creating an environment that says this is a safe space. This is a space where we realize these things happen in the world, and we all want to be here to support you.
When creating a space like that, if there is something that has occurred, like a sexual assault within a community, what do you think is the best way to respond to that?
Oh, it's like I said before, it's support. The best way is to believe the person who's disclosing. There's going to be so many people questioning that person that the best thing that we can do as fellow activists and allies and friends is to believe that person, is to not have any shoulds. There's no should in responding to a survivor. There is what do you need and what can I do to help. And that person might say at that time, I don't need anything. I don't want anything. And I don't want to talk about this. And that is okay. Everyone has their own process. Everyone has their own timeline. And even though, and believe me, as an advocate, I felt this too, even though I might be feeling, wow, something just needs to be done right now. If that's not what that person wants, then that is what we go with. So, you know, if and when they're ready, it's about doing everything we can to facilitate the healing that person needs and the response that person needs. And beyond anything, the more we can communicate our belief and that's not okay, what happened to you is not okay, and I believe you, the better. Because survivors have so many people questioning them, questioning their behaviors, questioning sometimes what they wore, you know, depending on what happened. There are so many questions that to have one person who says, I believe you, I've heard, you know, lots of women have said to me, that was just the biggest sense of relief I ever had. I knew I had someone who would support me, and that is what I needed.
Prevention. I'm wondering, what are some things that like female allies or bystanders could do if they notice a situation that might be creating or that could lead to sexual violence, etc.?
You know, speak up, really check in. There's a lot of work around bystander engagement is what we've been calling it over here in sexual and domestic violence movements. There's a lot of work about that. You know, if you see something, if you hear a sexist joke, if you see a campaign or you're in a campaign planning meeting, I was in one where they said, well, why don't we have all women wear nude bodysuits, right? Which is clearly copying off of another campaign. But I, you know, I because I felt comfortable. So if you feel comfortable, if you're able to do so, I was able to say no. and this is why, right? This is sexist, this is promoting specific, you know, images and roles for women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes we don't realize that that is being an active and engaged bystander as well. So it's about not only when you actually see something happening, when you're getting that feeling like, ugh, I really need to go see if she's okay, check in with her, maybe say, there's all these little tricks that bystander engagement curriculums give you, like, oh, I mean, to the point of summer, dude, your car's being towed, right? That's when you really feel like you just need to literally break something up. But, you know, there's also the really speaking up about, and to me, that's one of the most powerful about what we see happening in terms of, and what we hear happening in terms of the messages that are being put out there.
Related to that, I'm wondering, there's a lot of times as a woman when speaking up could come with risk. So I'm wondering when you think it's better to stand up and say something, and when is it better to walk away and let it go?
Right. You know, I don't know that I'm the decision maker on that one. What I can say is it's, and I think we all also have a responsibility to do this, is to not kind of blame people for not speaking up. I've seen that kind of be an unintended consequence of all this bystander work that we have been doing, is then people start feeling guilty. People start kind of shaming others for, you know, you're sitting right next to that guy who said that sexist comment. Why don't you say anything? Again, we need to realize we all come from different experiences and backgrounds. We all are given different levels of social power, right? Have different barriers and things that we have to think about. So we have to basically acknowledge that the way I would respond to that might not be the way someone else wants to or can. And so I think that the way to figure that out is, you know, go with your gut. I mean, it sounds kind of trite to say that, but that is something we kind of tend to say a lot in the work that I do, is also, you know, go with your gut. If you feel like, wow, I want to speak up, but I'm feeling really, really like scared about it, that's fine. You know, that's totally fine. You can, if you feel comfortable, you can talk to someone else and say, you know, I really want to say something. Would you say it with me? Right? There are lots of ways that we can kind of figure out, well, why am I feeling scared? And a lot of people, when they're feeling scared, they know, because that person knows this person who then might come after me, right? Like, that kind of stuff actually happens. And so we approach this kind of bystander work like, this is easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do. It's a great thing to do if you can.
I'm wondering, too, we were talking about female bystanders or allies before, but what about male allies and bystanders? How do you think they can be supportive and help to prevent sexual violence?
You know, it's interesting because I said, you know, let's not shame people, or, you know, let's understand everyone has their own process, right, and reasons why they may or might not stand up. I have to say I do have kind of a higher standard, a higher expectation for those who do identify as men to kind of speak up to other men who are, you know, perpetuating these. Again, if they can, right? There are a lot of reasons why some folks wouldn't want to, or wouldn't feel safe. But I think for men who absolutely, you know, especially those who are aware of things like privilege and power and oppression, and know that, you know, they benefit from it. And a lot of folks have done a lot of work around how they benefit from it, right? There's this whole new, kind of newish, you know, masculinities field of study. It's something that I said, I've done this for over a decade, and a lot of that has been work on engaging men. And I put that in quotes because it's a strategy we tend to refer to. And I think we're at the point where it's just your responsibility. I mean, it's your responsibility to, you know, kind of maybe not be liked as much by your peers, right? Like, that's a risk. To maybe lose some of your social power a little bit because you are speaking up and you are holding people accountable. I think that men in the movements, I'll say, really have a duty to speak up and to be active bystanders.
I'm wondering, too, in all this, because it isn't just women that can be affected by sexual violence. Males can be affected by, too, or people who might identify as other genders or sexualities. Yes. So how do those people fit into this discussion?
Right. You know, that's something that we're working on, I'll say, in domestic sexual violence movements as well. I tend to use the term gendered violence because I think that it's a little bit more of a nuanced way to talk about it. They absolutely do fit in. And I'll say, you know, I identify as a cisgendered woman. So those who are listening know, I am not, you know, and would never purport, say that I'm an expert on, trans identity or trans issue or, you know, other, sexual identities, other gender identities. But I do think that absolutely, we're at a place where I think we're starting to recognize maybe how we have excluded folks who don't fit into kind of the gender binary, who, you know, have not been as welcome in our movements and in our spaces before, and we're having those conversations. I can't say that we've figured it all out, but I mean, the way I feel is, you know, how a person identifies is who that person is. So, I mean, honestly, if we can just start there, I think that's going to be a major improvement. Like, let's respect everybody's identities and go on from there.
And that's an important note to leave it on. So that was Ashley Meyer speaking on sexual and domestic abuse in activist communities and the connections between feminism and animal rights. So to find out more about Ashley, please check out Ashley Jo Meyer, that's MAIER.com.
Tune in to The Reggae Show, Saturday, 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. with your host, George Barrett, alongside Louis Sutherland, selecting the best roots rock, reggae, lovers rock, rock steady, dancehall, dub, ska music, news and views. The Reggae Show on Vancouver, Cooperative Radio, CFRO, 100.5 FM, Saturday, 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Tune in, won't you?
You're listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio on unceded Coast Salish territories. Okay, so now we have some news for you. Good news and bad news. We'll start with the good news. So the good news is that the Ringling Brothers and Burnham and Bailey Circus will phase out their show's Iconic Elephants from its performances by 2018, and they've told the Associated Press exclusively that growing public concern about how the animals are treated led to that decision. So for the past several decades, I think all the activist effort in trying to get circuses to stop abusing animals has it's finally started paying off. And now moving on to the bad news. So to give a little bit of context, in July of 2014, two activists, animal liberation activists, were indicted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act for allegedly releasing minks and foxes from fur farms. They've previously faced state charges of possession of burglary tools after a police search during a traffic stop turned up wire cutters and other similar items. Both men pleaded guilty to the state charges and served jail sentences. They're now facing up to 10 years in federal prison if convicted of the new terrorism charges. And since we have a lawyer here with us today, Wayne, would you like to share some thoughts on that and sort of give an update on the recent decisions on what happened?
Sure. So the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a federal statute in the United States that basically enhances the penalties for routine offenses that probably wouldn't even lead to misdemeanor charges. So, for example, you know, many of us probably know someone, or many of us may have even done something like shoplifting before in the past. And generally, when you shoplift, you might get cited. Worst case, it's a misdemeanor case. What the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act does is it takes exactly the same offenses that were already criminalized and already would have been subject to some minor penalties and turns them into federal felonies that are subject to multi-year prison sentences and labels them as terrorism. Terrorism. It's a very loaded word, especially in the United States after 9/11. So there have been a number of prosecutions under the ATA and its predecessor statute, the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, over the past 10 years. But this is the most recent one and really the only the second one since the ATA became the ATA. And as you said, there are two individuals who were allegedly released some mink in Illinois, and they're subject to these terrorism charges. The case that was before the Northern District of Illinois and on a motion to dismiss yesterday was about the constitutionality of this statute. So a number of lawyers, and these are civil rights attorneys who have no immediate connection to the animal rights movement, the case was about whether this statute, which criminalizes these acts purely for political reasons and enhances penalties for political reasons is constitutional, or whether it violates the First Amendment to punish people specifically because they're doing something for political reasons. And unfortunately, the Northern District of Illinois, which is a federal court and a fairly well-known court, did dismiss the case and said, no, there's no basis for saying that this statute is constitutionally fraught. The case can continue. These two defendants can be subject to the penalties. Now, the silver lining in the case, and the reason I'm really glad CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, brought this case, despite the fact that they lost at least the motion to dismiss, is that the judge's opinion made clear that, at least insofar as he's concerned and the Northern District of Illinois are concerned, the statute can only be deployed against activists who have engaged in physical property destruction. Now, up to this point, there's been a lot of dispute and disagreement within the animal rights movement as to whether the statute might affect something as simple as leafleting, that if you did economic damage to an animal enterprise, you could be subject to terrorism charges. And I think what this case shows and the prior case in Santa Cruz in 2009 show is that that absolutely, definitively is not the case. And we need to make sure we educate our activists and people in the United States know that unless you're engaged in physical property destruction, including the removal of animals from facilities, you're not going to be subject to these charges. So, you know, it's a terrible thing that people face federal felonies and terrorism charges for something as simple as an act of compassion, releasing animals from places of violence. But on the other hand, let's make sure we educate ourselves and empower ourselves legally and know that if you're leafleting, protesting, engaging in disruptions as we do at DXC, you're not going to be susceptible to this sort of case.
Thanks, Wayne. And so the two defendants are Kevin Johnson and Tyler Lane. And to find out how you can support them, visit supportkevinandtyler.com.
Thank you. You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM, CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada, on unceded Coast Salish territories. Join us on our next week's show with Allison Cole, who will be taking a deeper look into the illegal Peruvian dolphin tragedy and other pressing issues. We'd love to connect with you online at animalvoices.org if you wanted to stream our shows or download podcasts, read our show blog, or learn about our upcoming events. You can also subscribe via iTunes. Please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show through Facebook or email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We will be closing the show today with a song called The Sexual Politics of Meat by Consolidated. I'd like to say thanks again to Wayne for joining us and sharing your wisdom and energy with such eloquence and passion. We would definitely love to have you back sometime. Stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening, and please remember to be kind to the animals.
Representation of patriarchal values. Meat eating is the reinscription of male power at every meal. The patriarchal gaze sees not the fragmented flesh of dead animals, but appetizing food. Vegetarian activities counter patriarchal consumption and challenge the consumption of death. Feminist vegetarian activity declares that an alternative worldview exists, one which celebrates life rather than consuming death. One which does not rely on resurrected animals, but empowered people. If meat is a symbol of male dominance, then the presence of meat proclaims the disempowering of women.
Please take our 30-second questionnaire, and to say thank you, we'll offer you an exclusive gift.
But in objectifying them, we take what we want from them and leave the rest out. We leave their death out and we take their bodies. We leave the images of their death out, but take the meaning of meat and apply it to women.